Cue those drums.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-boned. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me, to my right, Kate Fagan, ESPN W columnist. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
And Neil Payne, as always.
Hey, Chad.
How you doing?
You too.
Doing good. We're all here.
Sports Writer 538.
We're here in Boston.
You know, that sound you hear, listeners and us, is the thundering masses at the MIT and Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. Hello, Sloan. Woo! Thank you for coming to a live podcast taping.
I even had a joke prepared about big spaces and no people in women's basketball and being used to it. And then this looks more like a second-round NCAA game. Or like one of the games where they give away like free tickets. So
we have a t-shirt cannon that's coming later. So that's why everyone showed up.
That's like women's basketball.
So we should know, we are wearing our Adam Silver riding a bear into a pool of fish t-shirts that were inspired during our How to Fix the NBA Draft Lottery crowdsourced project.
I've discovered they're hard to explain to people.
Yeah, it is.
Like my sister on the way in, she was like, what does that mean? And I was like, do you have 4 or 5 minutes?
It's a long story.
And I can explain this.
It's the future of the NBA.
Exactly.
That's all you need to say. So what was your pregame routine for the live show? Did it differ from your pregame routine when you played college basketball?
No, it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
A lot of stretching.
Yeah? Threw up in the bathroom or something?
That's mine.
Yes.
Oh, that was yours.
Just to be like,
threw up in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Did my hair. Exactly.
Before college basketball game?
Always.
Really?
Yes.
Seriously?
Lots of makeup and hair. That's more than you think, actually. Yes, that happens.
Wow. I didn't know that about
you. Yes. Not me. My teammates.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You guys ready for a show?
Well, now I got to put on makeup.
Show. Yeah, right.
So.
Don't do that now.
So on today's special live show from the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, we will have a mini stats school. We often do stats school when some of us are on vacation, for example, but now it's a stats school.
It's not pure filler anymore.
Neil will don the stat man cape once again and tell us the best way to evaluate individual NBA players' contributions on the floor. Harrison Barnes will be our spirit guide. Then we're going to have a little interstitial. People in the audience, a question for those of you who are here. By show of applause, how many of you have won your office March Madness pool?
Oh.
All right. Fewer than I thought.
I thought more people.
So for those of you who have, think about why you won that pool in one sentence. We're going to ask you to come up and say so. And we, as the stat arbiters, will tell you whether that is founded in empirical reality or just total blind luck that you won your bracket. And then a guest star, Duke and Sloan legend Shane Battier, will be here to help us get ready for March Madness. We will talk about his time at Duke, how millions of office pools affect a college player's approach to the tournament, and what his own secret bracket strategy is. And then after that, Daryl Morey, general manager of the Houston Rockets, will be here to talk about what he's learned from a lost season in Houston. That's my characterization. May not be his.
See what he says.
And the state of sports analytics and how Stephen Curry affects the way he tries to build a team. And then finally, Allison McCann will be here for Significant Digit, and it will be about how a 17-year-old superstar, Mallory Pugh, of the U.S. Women's National Team, did in the recently named... I'm not going to spoil the name of that cup. We'll let Allison do it.
The recent
awfully named U.S. Women's
Pretty
Soccer
bad.
Cup. All right. Stats school. Neil, you left your cape at home.
Let's do this, yeah.
What? It didn't
you usually have your
metaphorical
cape.
Well, I can only wear one novelty item at a time, so we've got these t-shirts.
That's a rule that you've imposed for yourself?
Yeah, well, I thought it was all of us had that rule.
Okay.
So, next time.
I wear as many novelty items as possible.
Yeah, sometimes you do wear like those tacky New Year's glasses and things during taping. So
we should explain to that stat school for those who have not heard it before. This is basically when Kate and I get to be as ignorant as we actually are about advanced statistics? I don't want to speak for you, actually.
No, I'm right there with you. Yeah.
Okay. And Neil Statman guides us through basically an increasing complexity, something that is baseline for stats, then middle ground, and then usually super complex, that is the stat ideal as we see it now. We've done two on baseball, I think, hitting and pitching. We've done NFL rushing, I believe, a couple NBA ones. So Neil, Statman Neil, what is our massively open online course stat school today?
So it's a little like Trump University in that sense. Like we,
so it's a fraudulent.
It's a fraudulent class. Just
we're going to force everyone to leave good reviews on iTunes.
We have the very
though.
Best people up yeah. here, believe me. So yeah, today we're going to talk about just sort of a brief overview of the evolution of like analyzing NBA players in one number, and I'm sure many people in the room today have kind of been very familiar with these numbers, but. Just kind of going to go through the history and talk about things from the primitive era to the current cutting edge, at least.
Why do we need one number to explain a player? Why does that matter?
Well, I mean, I think it's kind of a shorthand that people have gravitated to, not just in basketball, but in all the sports. You see, like, the rise of wins above replacement in baseball, and in football it's a little hard, to be honest. But I think that's kind of the holy grail, and in some ways it's kind of a misguided quest, and that one number can never truly summarize a player's contributions, but that doesn't stop us from trying, and it hasn't from the very beginning of this whole endeavor.
Okay. First lesson.
Okay. So I believe we're gonna use Harrison Barnes here as our spirit guide through this. And the first step that we're gonna talk about is sort of the primitive pure box score metrics. And it kind of goes back to the 60s. There was this guy named Dave Heron, I think he was a writer for a newspaper in Florida, and he came up with something called Tindex. And I don't know what Tindex actually stands for. It seems like it should be like an acronym. So if you're listening, or
Dave,
maybe someone in the
right
crowd could tell me. So there was a guy that invented this metric, and basically it was just like he added together the good stuff that a player did and subtracted away the bad stuff. So like points plus rebounds plus assists minus turnovers, you know, minus missed shots. And that was the first really like metric that you could really use to describe a player that went beyond just, you know, scoring per game and the per game averages that you always saw. So it became more complex as the years went on, and you had a guy named Bob Bilotti created something called Points Created, where he took it to a next level and tried to account for a player's like the pace at which they played. And John Hollinger, as many of you in the room know, created the player efficiency rating, or PER, and that is the kind of the highest level that people push the pure linear weights mode of box score stats to. And
so,
yeah,
okay,
go ahead.
So when I hear PER, I usually think that is like an advanced stat. But
I use it as an advanced stat.
Yeah, but what you're telling me is like it's the top of a dummy tier or something of the lowest complexity tier.
Yeah, and apologies if John Hollinger is in the audience, but it's
John. Come
what
on.
What if he's not in the audience? Do you
come
still
on
want to
down.
Apologize to him?
You know, whatever. He took it to a level that was different than what Dave Heron had been doing, because he actually put different weights. Like in Heron's metric, all the weights were one on everything, or negative one. A point was worth one, and a rebound was worth one, and you kind of sorted your players that way.
So all of these statistics were about the player and what they accumulated on the court, and had nothing to do with the interaction between other players.
Yeah, okay. No, that was like
I'm absorbing
off.
When we say box score stats, we mean the box score that shows up
in the newspaper.
Right?
Yeah, printed, you know, and to varying levels. When Dave Heron came up with his system, it probably didn't have like turnovers in it. It probably just had like field goals attempted and made, and free throws, and points, and rebounds, and assists. But it was all about trying to kind of just add up the good things and subtract away the bad things. And Hollinger used different weights, so you know, he didn't think that a point and a rebound were the same, and he tried to use a little bit of empiricism in trying to figure out what the weights should actually be relative to each other. But in some cases, he was also just like admittedly like, well, this seems like it works out really well, and it doesn't have Michael Jordan, or it does have Michael Jordan leading the league instead of, you know, some rebounding.
Anything that he weighted differently that would be interesting?
I think a lot of his weights that he came to were, they eventually, when you looked at sort of correlations with things like adjusted plus minus, which we'll talk about later, they didn't totally not make sense. So, like, he was kind of on the right track. I don't think there was anything. The point of it wasn't to be groundbreaking, though. The point of it was to kind of summarize in a systematic way the things that we as fans or the common knowledge of the basketball public would have assigned to things, and then sort of just say, okay, this is what the conventional wisdom says that these things should be worth. Now let's run the formula and see what it spits out, and hopefully it has Jordan as number one. That was literally something that he admitted to as one of his goals.
I think I understand that.
Yeah. So what's that have to do with Harrison Barnes?
So if we look at Barnes...
And we should say to listeners at home, there is currently a chart up in Sloan, which imagine some dots on a field on two axes, as a scatter plot often is. And Harrison Barnes does not look close to the best players in the league.
Yeah, so the league average in PER is, by definition, 15 in any given season of
Why
the
is that?
NBA.
That's just
because Hollinger arbitrarily kind of made it that way. And I think it's to scale it to something similar to points per game so that fans kind of had a reference point where they could say, oh, you know, 20 is good and 25 is amazing and 10 is not so good. But anyway, back to Harrison Barnes. If you look at him... in PER, he comes in at 12.5.
And below 15.
Below 15, below average. His box score contribution, as defined by kind of the conventional wisdom, and this doesn't really make that much of an attempt to take into account defense. It misses out on a lot of things. It says that Harrison Barnes is a below average NBA.
The Warriors should trade him. Who needs him?
Clearly.
Don't even sign him.
Yeah. Cut him. Okay. So just so we're clear, I have a feeling Harrison Barnes might make a recovery in this next step after this.
You're going to give it away.
Yeah, I'm sensing the classic Neil Payne turn.
Which the bait and switch.
Yeah, it's a total bait and switch. So, Neil, what is the next step after this?
So, after, you know, sort of in the 90s and even into the early 2000s, the box score was kind of all that we had to judge players on, and you know, just trying to refine the ways in which it was the formula that uses box score numbers was composed was sort of the state of the art in a lot of ways. And Hollinger was kind of talking about things that were far more advanced than what you would see in the media at large. But then people started thinking about, like, hockey had plus minus and just judging, you know, how well does the team do while in hockey while you're on the ice. But in basketball, you could apply it and say, you know, there's enough substitutions that you can think about, well, if all that matters is winning and we want to know which players are associated with the team doing the best, why don't we look at the players who are associated with the best point margins while they're on the floor? That makes sense. And so people sort of started going down that road. And what you do really quickly when you start going down that road is you realize that it's not really an individual stat, even if you isolate the player's minutes. If you play with Steph Curry and Draymond Green, as Harrison Barnes does, it tends to boost your plus minus when you're on the floor.
So just so we're clear, plus... it's a good thing.
Pluses
you're on the
are good.
You're on the floor, someone scores, you get a plus.
That's right.
If you're on the floor when the other team scores, you get a minus.
That's right.
You want more pluses than minuses.
Right.
I'm picking this up. Yeah. Okay, so Barnes then, Barnes is much better, is what you're saying.
Yeah, if you look at Barnes in just straight up plus minus per 100 possessions, he shoots up to one of the best players in the league. He's not at the very top of the league, but he's one of the best. And by that metric, you can kind of see, like, it is picking up on things that PER misses. He is doing things that are valuable in ways that aren't showing up in the traditional box.
Because his team is scoring.
Right. I mean, we know this to be true from what we're going to talk about later, but it stands to reason that if you have a player whose plus minus is substantially different from his PER, then it's at least worthy of kind of digging into and trying to figure out, even if you're just doing like a scouting report and trying to say, like, what gives, what is the box score missing with this guy? Maybe it's not missing anything after you've done your analysis, and maybe you realize, like, he is just being propped up by Steph Curry. But at the same time, maybe you can kind of start to glean things that you wouldn't have realized if you had just looked at the box score.
So plus minus rewards players who are on good teams or part of rotations that are good.
Yeah, and it's possible to have a good plus minus and your team actually isn't that good, and that was one of the next steps that they tried to take to filter out some of the teammate effects in plus minus was, well, raw plus minus just looks at the team scoring margin while you're on the court. But you can take it a step further and say, okay, well, what about the team scoring margin when you're not on the court and take the difference between the two? That would seem like kind of a good adjustment to make and to try to filter out, like, if you're playing with a bunch of good players, then maybe they'll be on the floor when you're not on the floor, and they'll boost other players' ratings, and then we'll try to isolate you through that process.
But so that's, it's like flawed. Plus minus and plus minus in absentia.
Yeah, exactly. And that's like on minus, off court, plus minus. Sometimes you hear it called that.
I'm sorry, on minus, off court, plus minus?
Yeah.
Is there an acronym there we could use?
No, there's not even an acronym.
It's not even used
enough to warrant an acronym in it. Okay. So that was kind of a movement that started in the early 2000s, the mid-2000s, and people took it to really a very novel conclusion where they said, okay, it's not enough to just look at the team's performance on versus off for a player. You got to actually get down into the granularity of the five-man unit and say, like, who has he played with? Who are the other four players? Can we control for how good those players are? And then see, is this guy's performance better than you would expect based on who he's playing with and also who he's playing against? Why not? Throw that in as a thing, too. And so Mark Cuban, I believe, was he had a team of people, one of the first analytics teams of any NBA team, at least one of the first people to actually admit that they had an analytics team. And they created, it was Wayne Winston and Jeff Sagarin were the two guys, and they created something called WinVal. I don't know why it wasn't SagVal. It seems like Sagarin kind of got the short end of the stick there. But it was effectively what you'll hear called adjusted plus minus. And what this does is it dumps every player in the league into a giant linear regression, basically. And it says that the teams...
So that's just... Kate and I are both squinting.
Mean?
Yeah.
So it's the way in which it tries to control for all of the other variables. Each player is assigned a variable. And when you run a regression, you have a bunch of variables and you're trying to explain something in the kind of the best fit way. And in this case, the explanatory variables are just like, how good is Harrison Barnes? How good is Steph Curry? And the solution, in other words, a set of ratings that is assigned to each player that best sort of matches up to how well the five-man unit did, and not just that five-man unit, but every five-man unit in the entire NBA, that set of ratings are what we could kind of construe as the best estimate of how good this player is in terms of affecting his team's outcomes on the court after controlling for his teammates and his opponents and things.
Okay.
Ooh,
Neil, you almost hit the trifecta. You said best fit and explanatory variable, and you were just one more piece of lingo away from the full Neil Payne suite.
The triple crown.
Okay, so essentially we are trying to weight things appropriately based on eventual value?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we're trying to isolate each individual player in the league. So we know how well a five-man unit does when
by five-man
they're on
unit,
the court
you mean
together.
Five
a players.
Team. Yeah. Okay.
A group of five players on the court at the same time. So in kind of that definition, we know how good, for the stint that they were on the court, how much they outscored the opponent by. And if we know how good the opponent is, then we know sort of how well they've played relative to an average NBA team. So once you kind of have that, the question becomes, how do we disentangle these five guys from each other? Because that's kind of the problem with Harrison Barnes getting credit for everything.
So this is the third stage, right?
This is the third stage. We're moving into kind of transitioning into it is people trying to say that, like, raw plus minus isn't enough. We have to find a way to adjust for who a player is playing with. And so you ended up with an estimate of a player's contribution to the units that he plays in. But at the same time, it's like super noisy. And it doesn't stay consistent from year to year.
It's telling you something about a player.
It's noisy?
Oh, yes. It's loud.
It's screaming.
It's so screaming. Basically, it means that it can't really be trusted that much. Okay. Because you'll see guys be at the top of the league 1 year, and then the next year be at the bottom. But, like, they're not old. They probably haven't changed in skill. What probably has changed is the randomness of this measure, because there just aren't enough observations to be had.
So you're telling me not to trust it?
Well, it was a hiccup along the way. And so people developed things that were something called regularized adjusted plus-minus, which takes it to a new level and uses a different type of regression, but with a lot of things to try to kind of make a player prove that he's good before moving his rating substantially. So, for instance, if you're Steph Curry and you're playing at, like, a super high level, then it doesn't take long, it doesn't take much of a sample to kind of convince the metric that you're probably really good at basketball. But if you're hovering around average or whatever the kind of baseline for each player is assigned to be in the rating system, and again, this is kind of a customizable aspect of it, then you have to really change your level of play to prove that you have changed to become a better or worse player. You could play really badly and change your rating.
Kate, I see you smirking. All right,
go.
So this is what the 538 heads call Bayesian modeling, maybe, because we're establishing a prior of what we expect
Look
a player.
Yeah,
I've worked here for 2 years. Slowly but surely, it's bled into my brain. We're establishing what we think a player is, and then just because they have a really good set of games doesn't mean that they've all of a sudden become someone different, that we're slowly but surely inching our way towards actual value based on constantly reevaluating what we thought it might be.
Exactly.
I'm writing a book on Bayesian thinking.
That was way better than I expected.
So what does that mean for Barnes? Or are we not even at this highest level yet? This is
so
all part of the journey.
So we're about to get to, this is the journey to Barnes' final stop.
I need a water break, yeah.
I know, right? So finally, the last aspect, which kind of brings it back, and there was a funny quote right around when this adjusted plus-minus model was kind of all the rage and taking off, and Daryl Morey, one of our guests today, one of our esteemed guests, he had a quote where he said, somebody invented the box score and that person should be shot. And it was kind of this idea of the box score is totally inadequate for what we need to know about a player, at least what we can learn that will give us a leg up on other teams. And we need to build new systems that resemble this plus-minus metric. The final step, though, brings it back, and the creator of the box score shouldn't be shot, because you have a system, and right here, I should say, I've called it on the, for those listening at home, on the chart, I called it adjusted plus minus. It's actually what Nate Silver and I found to be the optimal mix of, to predict the future between the a box score prior, which we can talk about, and something called real plus minus. And at the end of the day, real plus minus is a mixture of the box score and the adjusted plus minus stat. It says that we're going to judge you based on how you make the team play while you're on the floor and do all of those adjustments. But we're also going to use a prior instead of assuming everyone has the same prior. We're going to inform that and become more accurate by using the box score to kind of figure out, like, do the things that you do in the box score, are they associated with making the team play better, sort of independent of knowing what your plus minus is? What would we predict your plus minus to be based on the history of similar players and how they impacted the game? And it turns out when you do all that, you actually get a pretty accurate estimate of how good a player is and what their contribution is.
Okay, so Barnes is back to average.
Ends up being back to average, kind of looping back around.
Cool.
After you don't shoot the guy that made the box score, but kind of include him in the valuation along with plus minus, you kind of get a more accurate estimator if you're trying to, when I say more accurate for a system like this, it's just trying to figure out, like, if I have a bunch of guys on my team and they're good in metric XYZ, so good at PER, good at real plus minus, How accurately can I predict how well the team will play in future segments of the season or in a future season if I mix and match and put together new lineups and try to figure things out that way? It turns out if you use PER that way, you're missing out on a lot of things. You're missing out on defense, and it does a pretty bad job of predicting how well a team or a five-man unit made up of certain guys will perform. But if you use real plus-minus, you do a better job of predicting, and that's how we know that it's a better metric.
Okay, Kate, how do you feel? You feel
I want
educated?
My certificate.
Yeah, you feel like you passed?
Everyone passed, and
we need a lot more certificates.
I thought we asked really good questions, too.
You guys brought it. Yeah.
It's
the electricity of the live audience, right. I feel
That's right.
All right, Statman Neil Payne, thank you for that crash
Remove
course.
The cape.
And take off your non-existent metrics. Cape.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, let's move on. While we get our next guest, Shane Battier, up on the stage, can we hear from those of you who have won your office bracket pool? How did you do it? What is your secret, analytic or otherwise?
So ride the hot team, UConn 2011, where they went through the Big East tournament. We're like 8 straight going into the NCAA tournament.
Neil, do conference tournaments mean anything?
Well, we've done some number crunching on it, and in general, a team's performance in the conference tournament doesn't tend to carry over into the...
So this gentleman got lucky, is what you're saying. You're looking in the eye.
I'm not casting aspersions on anyone. Yeah. It's good to be lucky.
Okay. One more.
My trick was to blindly go with my alma mater when, despite them cooling off in the second half of the year, 2013, University of Michigan. I actually had them going all the way, but just the fact that they were a 4 seed that made it to the final got me enough points to win, even though they lost that final
so
game.
So go to a school... Okay.
Does Neil need to debunk that one, do we think?
I think we're safe.
Okay. You chose right in school. One more, and then we'll get to Shane.
I won the year Syracuse won everything with Carmelo, so it was sort of just picking a player who was performing really well and was I don't know, getting a lot of attention.
Neil, do really good players matter in college basketball more than elsewhere?
I mean, not more than the NBA maybe, okay. But I feel like that's a pretty good strategy, as good as anything, I think.
Excellent. All right, now from some people who won an office pool to someone who actually won an NCAA championship, Shane Battier.
I've never won my office pool, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about your picking.
Don't broadcast that.
Okay. Do you think you know why? This year, are you convinced that you have the...
Yep.
Okay. You're not going to tell it out?
No, I can't.
People are going to listen. Yeah,
they might be listening.
Excellent.
The next year when you win, you'll tell us. You'll
be
one of the people.
I will.
So before Shane Battier became an embodiment of the new math in the NBA, he was a spindly forward. Is it okay if I call you spindly? I was good debating.
How about wiry strong?
Okay, wiry strong forward for the Duke Blue Devils in the late 90s and early aughts. 3-time NCAA Defensive Player of the Year, 1-time NCAA Player of the Year, and all-time liaison between analytics nerds and diehard athletes. Shane Battier, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Excited you're here. So you spent most of the day talking about NBA analytics.
Yep.
I want to talk about NCAA analytics with you. It feels like in the NBA we've had a revolution that's come. You know, we're not taking deep twos anymore. We're upping pace when appropriate, scaling it back when appropriate. Do you feel like that's happened in the NCAA game? Or do you still feel like when you watch the NCAA, you're still seeing a similar strategy and game strategy that you were playing yourself when you were there?
Well, I had the pleasure of calling a lot of college basketball games last year, and the answer is no. You don't see a whole lot of analytic truth in college basketball. Now, when I played for Duke many, many moons ago, I think Coach K was ahead of his time in terms of the analytics. He would tell us, look, as long as you hold up your end of the bargain on defense, I will never complain about how many threes you shoot. And we actually had a drill in practice. He put 5 minutes on the clock, and it was how many threes we could make. And our poor manager is running all over, just rebounding, passing. And if you look at the way that we played, we had some really, really good players. But we always had 4 shooters on the floor. We spread the court, high pick and roll. I was a stretch four before it became cool to become a stretch four. And we just bludgeoned teams with our offensive efficiency. No one could match us. We shot twice as many free throws as everybody. We lived at the rim, and we shot a ton of... We led the college statistics in three-point shooting. And that's the formula, modern-day formula, for winning in basketball. We were doing this back in the early 2000s.
Was that just a gut reaction by Coach K to how he wanted to play and not necessarily driven by any sort of data input?
He's an innovator. He's an innovator, and he obviously is an amazing recruiter, but he allowed his team's offensive freedom. And that's what you just don't see in the college game as much. You see, still see a really controlled game, coaches really trying to put their imprint on the game. And that is manifest by low possession games, low scoring games. Let's control, let's not get crazy here. Let's control the game, control the pace. When the teams, I think, have the best shot of winning, play a loose, open, aggressive offensive game.
Yeah, we were going to ask about that, about how much you hear about the college game being sloppy and, you know, kind of slow-paced or whatever. So do you think that that coaches that do that and kind of take that stranglehold on the team are actually doing themselves a disservice, and that if they just let the players kind of do what comes naturally, that something like the optimal strategy will eventually kind of emerge?
Well, no question. But the economics of being a coach come into play. Listen, there's not a coach out there that doesn't want to prove their worth. And you have to have some serious cojones. Can I say that here?
Yeah, yes.
It's a podcast. It's a podcast, right? Okay. You have to have serious cojones to step back and say, you know what, maybe our best shot of winning and our best chance of being a good team is actually letting my guys go. It's a very nice job to be a college coach, right? Mm-hmm. The benefits are nice.
Highest paid employee in every state.
Exactly. Private planes, you know, the fringe benefits, the salaries are great. And so that's a job worth holding on. Well, most college coaches think the best way to hold on to my job is to show everybody that I know what I'm doing. And I'm going to do that by strangling the basketball and making it a low possession game so that my strategy shines.
I feel like when you don't see that is when, like, a mid-major team has a really transcendent talent, C.J. McCollum, Isaiah Cannon, something like that, yeah, where those teams just let themselves live or die based on the great player that they have, and that's when the coaches throttle back because their system is too restrictive for the transcendent talent. Maybe that's
well, up. Yeah, I love watching the mid-majors that play a loose, open game. I don't really have designs to be a coach, but I swore if I did, it'd have to be in a warm state, so I'm not going to live where it snows. But I would try to be Grinnell College in Division I. I mean, what kid wouldn't love to go play, try to shoot 50 to 60 threes a game? I'm going to shuffle kids in and out, in and out, in and out. And if I'm a small school trying to compete with the big dogs, you have to be disruptive.
Right.
You have to go off the board, because you're not going to be able to just line them up, throw it in the post, and say, hey, go beat these trees on the other team.
That's kind of like the curse of having too much talent. It sounds like it wasn't as much of a problem for Coach K, and he gave you freedom. But like, if you're a small school and you need to kind of beat Goliath, you take on a lot of high-variant strategies that end up actually being the right thing to do more often than not, especially in a game that's shorter than the NBA, like in college. And the three-pointer seems to be as amazing as it's gotten in the NBA. They were on the curve of that early in college basketball, I feel like, of just like teams taking threes all the time. Yeah. But then if you have like a lot of talent, I feel like they don't play those disruptive styles. They try to like win based on conventional means. But imagine how great the teams would be if they had the talent and the crazy, you know, strategies.
You know, you looking for a job?
any coaching opportunities out there?
Assistant coach, you two of you, Grinnell. I want to talk about Selection Sunday.
Yeah.
Your Duke team went to the tournament all 4 years that you were in school. Did, as a player, when Selection Sunday came around, did the seeding matter to you? Were you thinking, oh man, if we're a four seed, that's a, or if we're a nine seed, that's an easier draw than if we're an eight seed or something like that?
What was the lowest Duke seeded?
You know, unfortunately, I didn't have that experience. I was the number one seed every year.
All right.
And
wow, man, said like a Duke.
I
would only imagine that it's a terrifying experience. But no, we had four number one seeds, and for us it was a matter of where are we playing. Are we playing in the East? Are we playing in the South? And normally we had pretty good geography for our first rounds, either Greensboro or Atlanta, somewhere close. But Selection Sunday for us, I wouldn't say it was like a celebration. You know, for so many teams, it's a great television shot to see the teams getting the tournament, they're jumping around. It was always really businesslike, because that's why all of us went to Duke. It was like, okay, the real season has started. This is what we're here for. So it was very businesslike. There wasn't any hooting and hollering. It was, all right, We're going to Atlanta. These are the three teams in our bracket. And the way Coach K talked about it, he didn't look at the entire bracket. He said, look, it's a two-game tournament. That's all we got to worry about. All right? We play Monmouth first round, and then we got the winner of Iowa and Middle Tennessee State. And those are the only teams we have to worry about.
Yeah, and I was going to ask, when you're looking ahead, and it's interesting to think that you only looked ahead two games at a time, were you kind of rooting for certain outcomes based on, you know, like, well, if this team pulls this upset, then it'll give us a better path, or we match up better with this team or the other, or were you just like, screw it, we're just going to go out there and we don't care who we're playing, we're Duke, we're gonna take on whoever we do?
We never worried about what other people were doing.
Okay.
You know, if we brought our game, if we brought our A game, the team, we'd be a tough out for any team.
There was no projection looking down the tournament and being like, okay, we've got this team there, but if that's upset, that's better for us. That never crossed your mind as you looked at the bracket when it came out.
We looked at that for other teams. Like, oh, like Carolina, you know, better hope for an upset here. So they don't have to play that team. But for us personally, it was, hey, whoever's in our path, they just happen to be in our
path. So you're telling us a sports cliche is true, one game at a time in the locker room.
Yes.
It might be true when you're like the number one seed.
Right, if you're really good.
Because like when we were at Colorado, first of all, the top four seeds for women got home court. So it was like if you were in that third or fourth range, there was a celebration happening because getting to play at home mattered. And if you were the fifth seed, you were not playing at home. And then if you're also kind of in that 12th to 15th ranked team in the country and don't come from the pedigree of Duke, I remember us, we would be like, okay, if we're the four seed, we would like it if this team gets upset. Because you're kind of like, well, if we get to the Elite Eight, that's going to be the best we possibly do. So we certainly, and I'm curious for players that were in that range of like 12 to 15th seed, you would certainly project, I think, if you weren't as, like, okay, we're the top team of the country.
Yeah.
You would do some of that projecting, I think. We did.
We got to ask a less accomplished player on
it. I know. Like,
I'm sorry, guys. The craziest thing that happened for us was probably my junior year. We were the one seed. We were a super young team. That's when Mike Dunleavy, Boozer, Jay Williams were all freshmen.
Chris was Car- that 2000?
That was 2000.
Yeah.
And that was the crazy year that Mike Miller hit the shot against Butler. Yeah. And Florida barely squeaked out that win. So we won our first two games in the tournament against Radford and Kansas, and we played Florida. And they beat us in the Carrier Dome in the Sweet 16. And so every time that montage comes on, and
one
they show
moment.
One shiny moment, they show Mike Miller celebrating at the bottom of the pile. And Mike's a dear friend of mine. I say, damn you, Mike Miller.
Did you talk about that when he joined the Heat?
Yeah. Whenever the tournament comes around, that's probably the best time in the NBA locker room because the trash talk's at an all-time high level. And if your team goes out, look out. All right. When Duke loses, I come in and I'm like, all right, let me hear it.
Right.
Let me hear it. And I tell people, look, there's only two stories here. There's only two stories that surround Duke. When Duke wins and when Duke loses. Either way, it's the top story on SportsCenter. All right. You can't say that about your school.
So we have to move on to our next segment in a second here.
Like a true
Dukey. Right, exactly, yeah. But come on, just share a little bit of bracket pick. Shane Battey, bracket picking strategy.
Okay. Strategy.
What's your go-to?
I'm a contrarian.
Okay.
I try to
don't want chalk.
I like contrarian chalk.
Yeah, Duke winning is a real contrarian pick.
Last year I was, and it worked out for me.
All right. Yeah, you didn't win last year?
I didn't win.
Man.
I didn't win. Okay. I didn't win.
So you don't always pick Duke?
Dukies always do two brackets.
There's
the Duke bracket.
There's the Duke bracket, and then like the non-Duke bracket. You want to be
a cop out
because people are like you're a homer and like
which you are,
then
which I am.
All right,
it's called mitigating risk, guys.
Spoken like an analytics nerd. Shane Battier, thanks for coming on Hot Takedown.
All right, thanks for having me, guys.
Excellent. Now we move from Shane Battier to his former general manager. He has been called Dork Elvis, that guy who stole James Harden from the Thunder, and the general manager of the Houston Rockets. Daryl Morey is with us. Hello, Daryl.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. So,
hello, audience.
We this podcast likes to highlight the best hot takes from around the world, the country. Usually just of the week, but for you, Daryl, we went back into the archives.
Yeah, we got a lot of hot right now.
There have been so many about your tenure in Houston that we reached back. Here are a year's worth of Charles Barkley's opinions on your job performance.
I'm not worried about Daryl Morey. He's one of those idiots who believe in analytics. And listen, I wouldn't know Daryl Morey if he walked in this room right now. Analytics don't work. What analytics did the Miami Heat have? What analytics did the Chicago Bulls have? What analytics do the Spurs have? They have the best players. They have coaching staffs who make players better. All these guys who run these organizations who talk about analytics, they have one thing in common. They're a bunch of guys who ain't never played the game, and they never got the girls in high school, and they just want to get the game.
Well, I just think Daryl Morey just screwed Kevin McHale. Obviously, me and Daryl Morey don't like each other because he's one of those analytic geeks who think you get numbers winning games instead of players.
Obviously, I don't like your general manager. I thought he threw you under the bus. You were in the Western Conference Finals 5 months ago, and after 11 games, I thought that was a disgrace and a travesty.
A disgrace and a travesty. Take him down, Daryl. What's your rebuttal?
I can't believe I agreed to this now. So
you didn't know what you were in for.
No, I'm sort of liking it, but sort of not.
That's what we're going for most of the time.
Yeah, just to be on Charles' radar, great player. How many titles did he win? I don't know. Yeah. anyway, he's... Yeah, I don't know.
That was a good rebuttal. I liked it.
That was my. We were on a panel together, so I would recognize him. He's
you wouldn't pretty, pass him by on the street.
Pretty iconic.
Kill him with kindness.
A guy that worked for us, Arturis Karnišovas, now works for Denver. Played against him on the Lithuanian team that played him on the Dream Team. Said he was by far the greatest player I've ever played against. So he's done a lot more than I have. So
okay. But one of the things you've done is have, I think, a pretty singular insight that people should stop taking.
I know one analytic jumpers. That Charles agrees
oh.
with.
Oh, what is it?
Whoever has the higher points in the game wins.
Hey, that's good. That's
so
good.
I think he's all for that.
He's all in on that one?
I think so. Everyone's in for that one, as they should be.
So your teams have sort of been known for no longer emphasizing mid-range jumpers, and I feel like the whole league is sort of caught up to that insight at this point. And I'm curious, as you look around the league, how long does an insight like that last in today's NBA, before the rest of the league sort of starts to adopt it and put it out on the floor themselves? Is it harder to be creative and innovative now than it was 5-10 years ago?
I do think the creating an edge and maintaining it is something we worry about a lot. And it gets more and more difficult every year. The sophistication at the teams in the NBA is very high. And any edge you have does get eroded away quickly. It's not quite as fast as Wall Street, but it's fast. So you always have to look for that next edge. I think they talked earlier on the baseball, or we didn't have a panel this year because we were going against, I think, Sabre mm-hmm. and all these. But they talked about baseball and Moneyball today. They had to move quickly to finding people with great defense, and because on-base percentage immediately got priced too high. So I think you see a lot of those dynamics. Yeah, 3-and-D guys getting tons of money in the NBA. I think more teams are spacing the floor better. I think more teams, Golden State sort of perfected a lot of the stuff that like folks like Mike D'Antoni and then teams before him from Europe and other places. They've really put the right personnel and a great system together.
Now, when it comes to your insight into Shane Battier, because he was kind of the, not Sherpa, what did we say? Oh, spirit animal.
Spirit animal.
For analytics. That's what we use for our stats goals. Nice. Did that come, and is that why you got him? Or seeing him day in and day out and being able to talk to him, was that what led you to believe that he truly embodied that ideal?
Well, we traded for him. The Rockets were an extremely successful organization before I got there. Hopefully we've maintained. We've conference finals, the third best record in the league over the last 10 years. So we've been pretty good, not as good as we want to be. But when I got there, there was a great group of folks that I worked with. They were all high on Shane. I was high on Shane. I didn't know Shane personally before we traded for him. We had the eighth pick that year, a pretty controversial trade, but we felt like with Yao Ming and Tracy McGrady in their prime, that he was absolutely the perfect guy. Tracy McGrady, we thought he was a perfect pick next to Tracy on the defensive end, and then at the same time on the offensive end, he could shoot from the perimeter, and he was an extremely smart player, which is something that Coach Van Gundy really optimized as well. So we had and he also underrated, but was part of a decision-making, an extremely good entry passer to Yao. And we like entry passes to Yao, like hitting the 100 on the ski ball, because, like, he was unbelievable when he caught the ball, but teams were very good at keeping him from catching it. So Shane was one of the best entry passers.
And with the way the NBA is right now, when you look at the Golden State Warriors and you're like, okay, to be able to get as good as them is right now such a struggle, and you see the NBA trading deadline pass and not a ton of teams making moves. Do you think it's playing into GMs and teams that the Warriors are young and good and so good this year that unless you can make a move that gets you up to their level, why make it at this point and wait and see what you can do in the offseason? Is that playing into people's decision-making process?
I think no, and I think rationally no. So, like, your odds are so long every year. I mean, it's, you know, obviously you start off with 30 teams where only one's happy. So just bad odds. Obviously the odds are actually quite much worse or better than that. Like, in a given year, you're probably looking at 23 teams going into the year with pretty much no chance to win. So that's pretty tough. And we feel like with James Harden and Dwight Howard and the right players around them, we've proven that we can beat the best teams. Are we going to be the favorites? No. Are we the likely winner? No. Are we a team that we think if we can get in a seven-game series, we can win? And yes, and we've proven we can do that. But if you just were to look at the odds, you wouldn't have a league. You'd just pack up. Everyone would go home. So the point is, you know, stranger things have happened in sports. A 16 seed is going to be the one seed, already did on the women's side by Jessica Gelman. And it's going to happen on the men's side. The reality is you don't want to fool yourself, but, you know, you got to be in it to win it.
So it's kind of like the Han Solo model, never tell me the odds.
That's interesting.
Speaking of the Rockets, you know, I had to bring in a Star Wars reference.
No, that's good.
He always does that.
Yeah.
What was that, Empire? What did you say that? I'm trying to remember.
It was Empire.
Okay. All right. He's humoring me now. He doesn't know, neither do I.
So the Rockets, got to talk about them.
Yeah, sure.
They're 32-32, eighth in the West. Before the season, the 538 model projected that the Rockets would win 53 games. Now we project you guys to win 42. So what went wrong?
Huh. Yeah, we've had a lot of... we've had a tough year. You know, we're not going to get them all right. You know, it's mostly been execution, and we continue to work on that. Obviously, you know, we had a lot go right last year. I think one of the dangers in this league is have success, like get to relative success, to get to the conference finals, and assume that was all, you know, all this great decision making that was all done perfectly. And the reality is, San Antonio doesn't lose on the last day of the Pelicans, where, you know, they're the 2 seed, we're the 6 seed. We're playing the Clippers on the road in the first round. If that's a road series and it goes 7, we might not beat the Clippers. I mean, we could have easily lost in the first round. Obviously, our guys had an unbelievable run and made it to the conference finals. The flip side's the same. Like, it would be a mistake to say just because, obviously, we're underperforming this year relative to what you thought, it sounds like, and we thought internally, to now say, okay, everything's broken. It means you need to take a hard look at what you need to fix and what you need to address, but you also need to, again, take a look at what needs to be fixed and so I'm repeating myself. That was good.
Well, so when you've been, you've been watching the Rockets this year, you at this point, yes. I'm assuming, as you watch them, or yes. Maybe there are times when you don't want to be watching them.
No, I watch them, for sure.
What have you gathered about what you need to do in the offseason?
Yeah, I mean, our defense is bad. Our transition defense is poor.
But why is it bad? Because it was good
Last year. It went from 7.
Despite the fact that there are all the jokes being made about James Harden, like, your defense was pretty good last year, and without tons of drastic changes, it's not good this year.
Yeah, if there was a straightforward ABC needs to be corrected and we're going to apply, you know, solution XYZ, we would have done it. So we're assessing, we're trying to find a lot of...
Are you doing your due diligence?
For sure. I mean, it's all we work on. So, and you know, every team that's underperforming, you know, you could go to them and say, "Why are you underperforming? Why don't you fix it?" Well, the reality is, it's a competitive league, you know, and it's very well-run teams, as we talked about. And you know, we feel like we can absolutely pull this together. The teams in the first round we feel like we match up with. Some of the teams that we would face in the first round, not all of them. But if we get to that, if we get to the right match in the first round, we feel like we need to advance. And then, honestly, once you advance, usually you're playing well and things can happen from there.
But I think this gets at the heart of sort of what we talk about a lot on the show, which is how versus, which is process versus outcome. And, like, when do you, as someone who is in charge, who's the one thinking of the process, look at the outcomes and know it's time to reevaluate the process. And we've talked a lot about what's happening in Philadelphia with Sam Hinkie, a former coworker of yours. And so, you know, at what point is the evidence, is the mountain of evidence big enough that you're like, you know what, maybe I need to rethink the way that I approach team building?
Well, I think that's a constant process. It's not a, again, our approach to team building, I think, is good. It hasn't yielded a title, and that's what matters. But we are only focused on winning a title. I do think that you can construct teams that, you know, win 45 to 15 games consistently but don't have a chance to win the title. We're not doing that. We're generally going for big bets and then fill around that. And you can debate good, bad, indifferent for that. But that's a philosophy that predates me. Our owner won the championship with the Rockets, traded for Clyde Drexler before the second championship. He could have kept it the same. Brought in Charles Barkley, a tremendous player. Those teams were extremely good. They didn't happen to win the title, but they were extremely good and could have won the title. So we've had a history of, and it's not an accident that I got the opportunity to work for our owner, Mr. Alexander, but because we mesh a lot in how we view and how we think is the best way to give us the best chance to win. But we're constantly assessing, so... You know, people like say we have bad chemistry this year. I don't agree at all. I don't remember any of the articles saying we had good chemistry last year when we won 56 games, made the Western Conference Finals. It's just the convenient thing to point to. And the reality is that that team last year is the same team now. And it's not like our group that had very good chemistry last year just suddenly doesn't. The reality is we're not performing as well. A lot of the guys who played very well last year are not playing as well this year. And we've had, whereas last year we had quite a few things go our way, a lot of good decisions and a lot of good fortune. This year we've had maybe not as good decisions and not as good fortune. And it's tough. It's tough to be in the middle of it. It's tough to get asked on hot takedown because I like winning, you know, and we've done a lot of winning. It's just we haven't gotten all the way to the ring.
Yeah. As a stats guy, we talk a lot about whether championships are also what, are really what matters when analytics would suggest you mount the best team, you know, you assemble the best team, and then variance happens. In the NBA,
well,
less so because...
most other sports. The NBA, that's harder.
Right.
So, like, yeah, you can plausibly construct a playoff team in baseball and football and say, hey, if you get there, it could be your year. That's, you know, sort of been proven. That's not the case in the NBA. You do have to be one of the top teams to win it. So it does change how you have to construct things. So I think I'd...
One more? Mm-hmm. As a former Sixers beat writer, Sam Hinkie,
yes.
Now in Philly, protege of yours or colleague or however we name it, do you understand what's happening in Philly from an outsider perspective? Are you like, okay, I can kind of see...
Their approach, I think, was exactly right. I think their approach is 100% right. You have to look at the starting point. So when I came to Houston, we had Yao Ming, we had Tracy McGrady, we were ready to win. Adding a Shane Battier was the right move. Taking a piece of our future in the pick and turning it into something that could help us win Shane was the right move. Adding Ty Lawson this offseason, we thought it was the right move. It didn't happen to work out, but we thought that that team deserved adding talent, giving up some future, because you don't get many chances in these windows. So that's when you know, Sam went to Philly, I think, in, you know, he doesn't need me to help him. He knows as much or more than me. Correctly assessed, that team was not ready to win. So the right thing to do is to take the approach they've taken. It gives them the best chance to up their championship odds over whatever window you pick, 3, 5, 7 years, whatever window you want to pick, he's up their odds significantly. People can maybe not like that the top draft picks go to the worst teams. People can maybe not like the structure or system they're in. But the approach they've taken, in my opinion, is right.
And is that based on stuff that, like, research that you and your team has done also on kind of the same questions?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, if we're not thinking about team building, how to do it, how to mesh personalities, how to optimize your odds, we're not doing our job. When Yao and Tracy were hurt and we could no longer win, we looked at the approach of, you know, going for high draft picks. And the reality was we had too many players on too many contracts. We could not get we didn't think we could get below 30 wins. And you need to get below 30 to actually get any of these high picks. So, and honestly, I'm competitive and our owner's competitive. We sort of rejected that path, and I think it was the right call. But I do think you can look at different situations and say, you know, we made the right call. Happened to both have some good planning and some good fortune to get a player as great as James Harden and have the room to sign Dwight Howard, and to say Philly's also doing the right thing, which is they looked at their situation and their best chance was to get high draft picks.
All right, Daryl, because we gave you a hard time, we want to give you a T-shirt.
Oh, I get a T-shirt
of Adam Silver riding a bear into a pool of fish, which is how the NBA draft lottery should be done. If you look closely, you'll see that there's a red fish, which is the Rockets fish. And if the bear eats the Rocket fish, then you guys get the first draft pick in the
upcoming
lottery.
Is it even odds? That's what I want.
Well, yeah, it depends.
Some of the fish might be bigger than others and more attractive to the bear.
You can game the system, Daryl, is what we're saying. You can place the fish that you want to place.
I have no idea what I just got, but this is cool. Yeah. This is cool. I like it, so I appreciate it. Thanks for
the time. Thanks a lot, Daryl. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Good to see you. Thanks
so much.
Home stretch here, audience. Thanks for sticking with us. You've been a great audience.
Give yourselves a hand.
Yeah, give yourselves a hand. And now the part of our show, every week, when we get a significant digit, a telling number from the world of sports. Alice McCann is with us at Sloan to bring us our significant digit. Alice, son, what have you brought for us?
Well, if anybody listens, they probably know that I never have a digit. It's always like some weird form of a number, and it's usually like women's soccer or women's sports in general. So, didn't want to change it up for Sloan.
No.
This week's significant digit is twice as much, or 2x. 17-year-old Mallory Pugh on the U.S. women's national team had twice as many 1v1s as any other player on the team. In last week's She Believes tournament, which we can get
about?
Into the name, but she had 14 1v1s. The next highest player was Carly Lloyd with 7.
What do you mean by 1v1s for people who aren't familiar with that?
That's just taking on a player, going at someone, and getting around them, or not getting around them, but just having the initiative to.
So she's twice as good as Carly Lloyd.
She is now twice as good as Carly. No, she actually, I mean, her success rate was the same as Carly's, which I think is also very interesting. She's not only taking on players, but very successful at it. And I think it's just remarkable that she's 17 years old and she's getting in 3 games against 3 of the best teams in the world, no less. Like, these were not garbage games. And she's going at players in a way that other players that have been on the U.S. team for, you know, a dozen years now are not doing.
And she was the player who we thought was going to skip college and go directly to the Portland Thorns.
Correct. But it seems like she's not. She's going,
do you have any insight into, like, I can understand the decision, obviously, but do you have any insight into, like, why she decided UCLA and not Portland?
I don't have any insight beyond speculation. That
give it to me, then.
I'm sure. I think that it is a big leap to take, and not the money is not there in the way that it is in
What is it, like maybe like $30,000 or something?
Yeah, so probably around there. Portland.
But also, it's still pretty, I mean, this sounds almost like a measure, like, akin to usage rate or something like that in basketball, where it's like measuring your aggressiveness at, you know, just forcing things to the defense. And so, as like a 17-year-old, is she like the next LeBron of the U.S. women's national team? Like, is she, you know, a player of that, like, precocious stature as a 17-year-old?
I don't know. I think a lot of the, you know, discussion around her and anyone that's this young, she's the youngest player to have been with the full team, has been, you know, does she have the confidence and, you know, does she
sounds
have,
like
will,
it.
Will she be comfortable? Right. Yeah, and I think that this is really interesting, and also something that I noticed in this tournament is that now they're playing in this new style without having Abby as this target forward, and we're seeing her sort of changing the dynamic of this offense in a way that I think we haven't seen before. They've had Abby for so long, and this style was dictated by long balls, and now we're seeing sort of a shift in this, and it's only been one tournament, and sadly that's not enough data to really say something smart, but I do think that we're going to see a really different style of play.
So she's getting these 1v1s off of like build-up and lots of passes.
Correct.
Which is kind of how a lot of people wanted the national team to play, and Abby was leading them in a different direction, right? That was the argument, was that there was too many long balls. So her 1v1s are coming off of the type of play that people have been wanting to see from the national team.
Okay. And the Stathead recommended style of play.
The Stathead recommended.
Always looking out for the Stathead recommendation.
Right.
So is this surprise? Like, I often think that, especially on national teams, there's generational change that takes a while. Sometimes you have a gap cycle, basically, where a team that wins the Women's World Cup, for example, you'll have a sort of down year, a fallow period before new players come and take the mantle from the other ones. Were we expecting a great player to emerge so soon on the women's national team?
I don't think so. I mean, it wasn't even on my radar during the World Cup. And this isn't to say I don't think she has changed this as much. The actual percentage of long balls were the same during the World Cup as this past tournament. So we're not seeing a drastic change in the style.
Okay, so they're still playing a ton of long balls.
I think it was around 17% in both tournaments, which is, I think, pretty standard for them. But yeah, I think that it's going to be interesting to just see the shift. We were the oldest team at the World Cup, and now we've lost, I think, 3 or 4 of those older players, and now we have someone that's 17 and impacting the way that this team plays.
Should we talk about the She Believes tournament and the name She Believes? Whose idea was She Believes?
It was Allison's.
Was mine, yes.
Surprised.
That was like their slogan during the tournament, which like felt totally different. And then I guess they decided to like bring it back for this tournament. It was new. It was the first year they had done this, and maybe they were scrapped for ideas.
They just went for the first idea that came to mind.
Yeah. I had nothing to do with She Believes.
Okay. All right, Allison McCann. Thanks.
Thank you.
That will do it for this week's show. Thanks, as ever, to Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne, you brought it today.
Aw, thanks.
Better,
so
better
good.
Than
thank
usual,
you,
even.
Chad.
To Sloan, to our audience, thanks very much. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast overseer is Jody Avergan. Our intern is Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're on iTunes as well. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chad McMatlin. Talk to you next time.